we'll kick things off. To all of you who are joining us, thank you so, so much for being here. Wherever you are, whatever time it is, we really appreciate that you would take the time to come and hear us speak about something that we think is quite vital and important and needs way more attention than it's getting. And we're glad that all of you feel the same way as well. You would have seen a note when you entered the Zoom room that this is being recorded, but I just want to emphasize that for anyone who isn't aware that we are recording this. We will also put this up on YouTube afterwards for anybody who wants to share it afterwards, pass it around so that word continues to spread, please do. I want to start with a big thank you to the Himal team behind the scenes. They've put in a lot of work to make all of this happen. They're the invisible force. If you could please send them good vibes and thanks for everything they've done. And with that, I think to dive right in, I think all of you know why we're here. Just a month ago, there was a pre-wedding celebration at Jamnagar, the world's largest petrochemical refinery. And I think a lot of people were surprised that there was a massive set of animals there as well. And, you know, of course, a lot of questions about how they came to be there, which I think nobody had really done a very good job of answering. The star of the hour, Emraj Shekhar, had been looking at this closely for a while and has also, I think, dug up a lot of answers, a lot of concerning answers, both in terms of what is happening at Jamnagar and how the animals have come to be there. But also, I think, the larger ripple effects of all of this. And I think that that's really where today we hope to dive more deeply, because of course the story is there. It's all available on our website at himalmag.com. I'm sure all of you or most of you would have read it. Today we want to dive deeper into those wider questions. So before we get into that, I do want to very quickly, for those of you who are new to Himal, introduce myself and the magazine. My name is Roman Gautam. I'm the editor of Himal South Asian. Himal is now in its 36th year as a magazine of the region, started out in Kathmandu, now based in Colombo, but with an editorial team spread across the subcontinent. What we do and what we love doing is really looking at South Asia like nobody else looks at it. We cover all countries across the region, from Myanmar to Afghanistan, from the Himalayas to the Indian Ocean and everything in between. Which is something that no other magazine has been doing in this way for this long. And I think that gives us a very unique audience, a very unique position, and also the privilege of being a very unique magazine that can speak across lots of lines, whether those are national borders or red lines in terms of things that maybe the mainstream media would not touch or certain nationalist taboos get in the way. So that in a nutshell is the essence of Himal. What we do in terms of independent journalism is very hard to do, very expensive to do. So to all of you who are here, I do want to also say, please do support Himal. We will be putting support links in the chat as well. If you would care to help us out, please become a patron. We have a great patron program that, you know, we'll give you lots of goodies in return and welcome you into the Himal community, and you will be helping independent media do what needs to be done. So off to our panel. I want to quickly introduce our great panel. I mean, they all have sparkling academic and professional CVs. I will not read those out to you, but I will say that they are stars in their field, each one of them. Of course, there is Emraj Shekhar, or Shekhar, investigative reporter. I think maybe by now has earned the term veteran investigative reporter, and also author of a great book, Despite the State, Why India Lets Its People Down, correct? Yes. So thank you, Shekhar, for the story, for all the hard work, and for being here. We have Shivani Ghosh, who is a public interest environmental lawyer, and also somebody who knows the law and has studied all the factors around it very deeply. And we have Dr. M.D. Madhusudan, or Madhu, if I may. He is an a conservationist and a scientist, specifically a wildlife biologist. You know, when we talk about conservation, I think Madhu has worked both with animals and also with humans, meaning the human communities who are so crucial to conservation as well. So I think he brings that very wide lens to our panel today as well, which is very welcome. Madhu is a co-founder of the nonprofit National Conservation Foundation, but I believe today working largely independently. Madhu, correct me if I'm wrong on that. So yeah, I'm going to start posing questions to the panel very shortly. When we had asked all of you to register for the event, we were also, of course, inviting questions. So I do also have an extensive list of questions from the audience towards the end of this event. We will be diving into those. Apologies in advance if I'm not able to cover all of them. I will do my best. Also in the group chat, please go ahead and throw your questions in. And at the end of the conversation, we will cover as many of those as possible. And I do want to start with maybe just one question before we dive in, because I think, you know, some of the questions that we got, or this question that we got, one of them was from Sandeep, who asked, why is this not spoken about in mainstream media? And I think that's a very good question. I think that you'll have to ask that question of mainstream media itself. I think they have a lot to answer for on that front. But of course, I think that the fact that Reliance owns massive stakes across the mainstream media in India does have an influence on the way that the media is structured and the questions that are asked and how coverage is done. In the absence of mainstream media looking at certain things, small newsrooms can do a lot. And small newsrooms like ours and independent journalists like Shekhar can also do a lot. So once again, please, if you think that this is something that the media needs to cover, we can't rely on the mainstream media. We'll have to rely on independent media. So please join us, become a patron of Himal, and we'll make sure that all of those resources are put into more great stories like this. So with that, I am going to start things off by putting a question to Shekhar. I'm going to assume that most people here have read the story, but of course, we will drop a few key reminders so that everyone remembers the key points that the story raises. But before we get into that, Shekhar, maybe you could tell us the story of how you got into all of this in the first place.
Right. To start with, we will borrow a leaf from Lok Sabha TV and expunge that remark of yours about the star of the moment. One. Two, to everyone here, the 100 people blowing their evening listening to us, thank you. I wanted to sort of explain why we are holding this discussion. And the answer will sort of come through how the article itself came about. Work on the article started shortly after I saw a video hyperlinked in the story where you have a bunch of elephants stopped in Pasighat, Arunachal. Somebody filmed this in the night, on one night in June 22. These elephants were in a convoy of 10 odd trucks, flanked by two SUVs, being driven at the peak of the summer from the eastern end of India to the western end of the country. And it was a profoundly disturbing moment. And then and there, you sort of know that this is something that, as a reporter, you have to try and understand a little better. Shortly thereafter, it so happened that I had a couple of conversations with a couple of friends who are biologists. And they began sort of talking about a bunch of really fantastical numbers in terms of 200 elephants already at the Reliance refinery in Jamnagar, untold numbers of big cats already at the refinery in Jamnagar, and so on. And I think the first stage of working on any report is one of general befuddlement, where you're not able to arrange what you're hearing into anything approaching sense in your head, right? At the same time, so this is a stage of pure curiosity where you don't really know what the big picture is. You're really absolutely groping in the dark. And in that sense of general perplexation, I traveled down to Guwahati and, oh, sorry, let me just go back. So you have a couple of these conversations and you hear extraordinary numbers and you're not able to figure out what is going on. Why would anybody want so many animals, right? You try talking to some people who might have a take, but you again start running into these walls. There's very little public information on any of this. There are some reports from reporters in the Northeast about elephants, but there's very, very little in terms of other species. One thing that I've been finding as a reporter over the years is that it helps to go down to the ground really quickly without waiting for things to coalesce in your head. Okay, without sort of waiting to articulate your questions very clearly before you'd start investing in that reporting trip. And so I went off to Guwahati. You start doing the usual set of interviews, trying to talk to a cross section of the political economy around wildlife and wildlife management in Assam. And then I went from there to Namsai. And this is a purely exploratory trip. It is good to be on the ground to sort of try and start assimilating what is going on. So I came back from that reporting trip without too many answers, but with a better sense of with a better sense of this jigsaw puzzle. You sort of hear about the elephants, you hear about illegal wildlife trafficking coming in, and then the role of the Guwahati Zoo in all this. So you see some things a little more clearly than before. There is just one is still absolutely in the dark about a lot of things, but some pieces of the puzzle are relatively visible, right? I come back to Bangalore. Then there are more interviews. I go back again to the Northeast thereafter, a little better prepared, and then more focused trips follow. What you're finding by this time, and the accumulation of this, two trips to the Northeast, one trip to Gujarat, one trip to Delhi, is that a little more of the superstructure becomes available. Like you realize gradually that animals are coming in four different directions. There is the route that the elephants are taking, there is a route that the exotic species smuggled into the Northeast are taking, there are the animals which are being brought in from other countries. Be it private collections or whatever. And there are the animals coming in from forest departments and zoos and so on, right? One of the sort of foundational tenets of journalism is that it usually takes you a long time to start arriving at the key questions. In this case, as the reporting continued, right, and one starts hearing that the zoo in Sakarbagh has given 100 leopards to Vantara, right? Or that species like the Spix macaw are being brought in and so on and so forth. And you sort of also end up hearing a lot about the management structure, which is running both the Radhe Krishna Trust and the Greens Zoo, right? Gradually, you find yourself coming to a point where there are two large questions, okay? Or two large processes seem to be playing out. The first of these is that this is a corporate philanthropy project which started off with perhaps the correct intentions, but has progressively mutated into something unrecognizable and extremely poorly understood. So, Recently, we had a book on Bill Gates' philanthropy, right? Where you have a very rich. What's going on here?
We
Yeah.
have hit the limit and more people trying to get in, so we're also putting this out on a live stream for people to join that way.
So what you slowly start finding is that two processes are underway. One, as in the case of the Bill Gates philanthropy, where you start with a particular set of ambitions and goals, but gradually that thing acquires a very, very different sort of a meaning and then impacts upon the world. And you find that something similar might be happening in the case of Bantara as well. Okay. It like one person I interviewed said that the starting idea for this was good, but progressively the intent of the organization has changed to we want more animals, right? And this is something that has to be understood. This is still, however, an organization level detail. The deeper process here is that you sort of see the state governments providing a very, very supportive environment. I happened to meet the Chief Wildlife Warden of Gujarat, and then what he told me is that we are not, our zoos are underfunded. We are not able to look after our national parks well enough. Any companies should come in. Any company with passion should be allowed to come into this. And what you're seeing here, I mean, I write a lot on privatization and, you know, sectors like infrastructure and so on. And the narrative there is that of underfunding, mismanagement, running the asset into the ground, and then giving it to a private guy who then sort of proceeds to monetize it, however, right? A similar narrative seemed to be taking place here, where you have biodiversity being privatized. Okay, and the curious thing here is that now it is so safe to say this, that in the environmental history of India, right, and in our history of how we have managed our forests and our wildlife right up till this point, bringing in the private sector would be a very, very large disruptive step. However, I haven't seen a single discussion on this, right? There is no policy paper from the government saying that this is a direction we're considering. There is no clarity on the point on how it was decided that A, surplus animals are going to be given over to Reliance. How were they chosen? These are questions that the High Park Committee has not asked. The media hasn't asked. So it's kind of like a privatization by stealth. And this question seemed like something that we should be getting into more detail about, because if you look at the global history of the overlap between biodiversity management and the private sector, you have horror stories. You have South Africa with the captive lion farms. You have the US, which has more tigers in farms than actually in the wild. And so the question comes that, you know, are we heading in that kind of a direction? Right? This, I think, is the superstructure on which everything stands. And I was chatting with Madhu, and he said that, you know, in the discussion, we should explore this particular aspect of privatization better. That this is not the first time we're seeing privatization. I mean, in terms of wildlife being given to Vantara or Kevadia being given to Reliance, Vantara is an extreme manifestation of this trajectory which has been playing out for a while. And the reason for this conversation really is to sort of understand what is this moment in the history of wildlife management in this country? Where are we going? And with that, I will now shut up.
No, I wanted to say yes to open up more questions, I think, that arise from this story. I think it's absolutely correct that I mean, the story has done a lot of, I think, has raised a lot of questions about what's happening at Bantara, but the questions hardly stop there. And it is really, Shekhar, as you described it, that superstructure that becomes so important. One thing very quickly to say, I mean, you were talking about how, you know, one of the people you spoke to was saying that it started out as one thing in terms of trying to help animals, but now it's become just about getting more numbers. Just to say that Reliance, of course, vehemently denies that. We've raised multiple questions in the piece about how and why Vantara has come to be and taken the shape that it has. They vehemently deny any wrongdoing, and I think there was a question in the chat as well about whether there have been any further responses to the questions we sent out. Of course, the story extensively quotes the responses that we did receive from all the people that we reached out to, including Vantara. We've not had any more replies. That's just briefly to answer that question. And Shekhar, I think since you were talking about Madhu as well, I think we can segue right to Madhu. And again, just building on those wider ripple effects, I think Shekhar was talking about Vantara as being the manifestation of larger forces and larger changes at play in wildlife and conservation and biodiversity management in India. So I wanted to ask you if you could perhaps maybe rewind a little bit on that big picture question that Shekhar was talking about, the privatization of wildlife and biodiversity management in India. Where does it really begin? I mean, because it doesn't begin with Vantara, like you were saying with Shekhar, that is the manifestation of a set of processes. Where does it begin? Where does it stand now? And what repercussions could there be going forward that you see from your vantage point?
Thanks, Roman. With your permission, I'll try and come back to the question, and if I don't, please feel free to nudge me. I'd like to set a bit more of context to this,
Please.
as I have seen a lot of reactions on social media that have been very welcoming of a place that's it embodies and reflects a spirit of generosity, kindness to non-human species, and they're being rescued and they're being given a better life. And what could be wrong with something like that? And I think it's for those of us who are not professionals in this field, for those of us who are professionals in this field, we might see it a certain way, but I think a large majority of the people do not see this in the larger context, and that's fair. And I think so. I would like to do a little bit more of context setting before we get into the issue of what, if any, the perversions are that we are witnessing here. So, yesterday, a paper was published in the journal Science Advances that talked about the overlap between great apes. I'll begin with this because I think it's difficult sometimes to see under our own noses. It's often easier to get perspective when you look farther away. So hence, I'm coming to this paper that was published yesterday, which was on the overlap between mining for a whole range of metals that are really important to the transition to a low carbon energy sources for lithium, cobalt, all of those, a large repository of which remains in the continent of Africa, where also a very large number of the remaining, at least the African great apes that are found nowhere else, are obviously African, the chimpanzees, the bonobos, and the gorillas. So they're found in Africa as well. And this paper looked at the overlap between these great ape species and mining. And beyond the obvious impacts that these forests, which contain great apes and also happen to contain these precious metals for which mining is becoming a growing activity, there will be the obvious destruction of habitat. There'll be the opening up of roads. There'll be noise pollution, light pollution, hunting, and all of those things. And one of the first things that we're going to see there are, a complete cleaving and destruction of populations of these animals. And we've seen this happen with orangutans in oil palm plantations, as forests have been broken up to oil palm concessions in Southeast Asia and so on. So what we will see are a large number of these great apes that will come, that will become refugees as these landscapes get transformed. So I think what we are seeing here is a proposal, something very similar is happening all around the world. You can change the great apes for a set of species that are entirely Indian. You can replace mining for a set of activities that are our own, including mining. And you can change the place from Africa to pretty much any other place around the world. And I think the theme remains the same. And here, what we are seeing is that here is a proposal to try and bring all those great apes into a fantastic facility where they would live luxuriously and will be very well cared for. Now, is that a problem? I think it is fundamentally a problem because it is allowing us to look very strongly away from the fundamental issue, which is what is making these species become refugees in need of rescue centers. So, from there, let me come back to a key point that I want to make. Animal rescue, important as it is not wildlife conservation. I think it's a distraction from wildlife conservation. Why do I say that? I say that because wildlife conservation is not animal husbandry of wild animals. Conservation necessarily takes a broader view of the overwhelming ecological value and functional significance of wild plants, animals in their natural habitats and contexts, and the cultural significance all of that holds to humans. Take the elephant, for example. In the wild, they have huge ecological roles and they perform functions in the ecosystems where they occur. They're constantly interacting and relating to other plant and animal species around them. They disperse seeds of many trees. They're ecosystem engineers that constantly modify ecosystems where they occur. Their intelligence, their power, the grace they bring into these ecological roles touch our souls and they stir our imagination and they make places. What would you think of a place called Anai Malai, which in Tamil means the elephant mountain, without the elephant? And the kind of changes we are trying to bring upon our landscapes are, in fact, the changes where an elephant mountain may remain with no elephant. So take the same elephant into captivity, and it's rendered nearly worthless in terms of its ecological role, as it is severed from its ecological context and relationships. It is diminished in every way. In captivity, we are housing mere pale shadows of these creatures that are otherwise so full of ecological relevance and cultural meaning. Consigning a wild animal to a life in captivity, be it in the most luxurious facility, is like taking apart a beautiful watch, storing all the nuts, bolts, springs, wheels, and so on, or like taking apart an exquisite carpet and sorting and storing all the colored threads that make it. Even if you put these into the prettiest of jars, you are hugely diminishing the value of something vastly precious and valuable. That said, it's very important that we must worry about the welfare of captive animals, but that has to stand firmly on the foundational idea that the place of a wild animal is its natural habitat, the wild. And therefore, every instance of the abomination of captivity, which is what it is, must remind us that we must commit to safeguarding and protecting the natural habitat of these species. Now, let me take a step back. Whose job is it to safeguard and protect the natural habitat of these species? The government, of course. But over the years, as trustees of the government has slowly but surely retreated. Governments across the world have slowly and surely retreated from their roles as trustees of public lands and public resources, both living and non-living, and that they are meant to hold in trust for and behalf of all citizens. So it's not me, the intergovernmental panel on biodiversity and ecosystem services has said that overwhelmingly in the 20th century, it is corporations and their activities that have been responsible for the loss of biodiversity across our planet. And corporations, with the kind of financial money, the power that they're able to move, they seldom need to do things illegally. They have the power to change governments, they have the power to persuade and pressurize to pass laws that suit them. So, a lot of what is being done is deeply illegitimate without being technically illegal. I think that is the key part that we must all worry about a lot. For instance, there is a whole a nest of these conflicts of interest that run deep. At the highest levels, it might be problematic political funding. But look at regulatory agencies. We've had a state in southern India that has brought a person who has current mining interests into the state wildlife board as an expert to decide how decisions must be made in the state board for wildlife. And if you take this further down, we have parks, we have tiger reserve foundations, and so on, that have really cozied up to people who have deep interest in these parks and in these places. So they have presence on regulatory institutions, and they have the ability and the money power to bring ex-civil servants and so on who have created and managed these administrative systems for decades and help them, leverage their seniority and networks and help them navigate through all of this. So if you really look at this worldwide, there's something called Nature Benchmarks 2023 by the World Benchmarking Alliance, and they look at a variety of things under the Nature Benchmarks, which is trying to see how responsibly companies generate the wealth that they're supposed to be generating. And Indian companies, of the 400 or so that they assess, including Reliance, are right at the bottom. And I'm not holding this benchmark as some high watermark of corporate environmental stewardship, but even by its measures, we are really, really faltering. So I think to come back to what we were saying, governments across the world have seen nature for the value it holds to expand the human domain of industry and economy. Nature is most welcome if it is fuel for growth, but not as something that we must truly care for and protect. The way our growth machines are being designed, it appears that we are completely focusing on building faster and faster engines for our economic growth, but we have completely forgotten about making our journeys in these machines safer, our journeys to growth and development safer, because and build safe brakes, which we need as much as we need fast engines. The conservation impulse provides the safety of those brakes. And when we don't have that safety and we start to pursue speed over safety, what the accidents that we have are going to be, more and more common, and they're going to repeat. And at that point, there are going to be a whole bunch of vulnerable people who will suffer, and there'll also be a whole bunch of vulnerable wildlife itself who's going to be among its victims. And we can't then say we're building a wonderful facility for all these victims. We really have to go back and ask, why are there accidents? Why should we be having these accidents? Why should we be building these facilities for the victims? Because the solution is not, we must question the fundamentals. Should we be pursuing growth at all costs? And growth without safeguards. So, when rogue corporations are doing what they do best in the pursuit of private profits, loot and scoot, it is up to the government that we must look to ensure that this does not happen. But this is not happening as it should. Regardless of political color, governments have cozied up to corporations and are failing not only to control them when they inflict public pain for private gain, but they're often enabling and even colluding with them by commission or omission as they pursue their profits. So I think this is the overall context in which I think many animals that are being displaced, the need for rescue, why are there so many animals that we are taking into captivity? There are hundreds of leopards coming into captivity. As you see, we already have hundreds of elephants in captivity. Why are we getting so many of these animals in captivity? That should really be our lookout, rather than saying we'll build wonderful facilities for these species. There are species from outside this country that are showing up within our borders that don't belong to India, that are showing up within our borders. What are our agencies doing? Why are they not effective? The solution is not to take these and find a place, a nice place to put them in. That, I think, is getting everything upside down. And this is the kind of perversion that happens when the conscience keeper or the referee in this larger conservation game, if I can call it that, is really not playing that role properly, and I think is much more is listening much more closely to the to what the corporate world has to say, rather than to what its fundamental trusteeship demands. I'll
And
stop there. We
okay,
can
may
come
I
back
come
to
in
the,
here?
I think, yeah.
Sure, Sir Shikhar, jump in.
Madhu, tell us a little about how these foundations are working in national parks. There was that overlap with the private sector there.
In my understanding, foundations in tiger reserves are not audited like government agencies or government departments are. They are financially, they function financially independently, which means they're able to take donations from individuals, corporations, and so on. And in many of these places, there is very, very likely to be situations where people with an interest in something that has to do either with the enforcement roles of the agency, also manning the foundation and so on, or have interest in the park for a variety of things. It maybe it's tourism, maybe it's something else, or have reason to be to seek and find favor. And this the very structure of something like this is I think causing an enormous complication in an area that is and opacity in something that really needs to be a part of the larger overall role of governments.
Absolutely. And
So just to, sorry,
go for it.
just to flesh this out for the people here, give us the example of such a foundation and a tiger reserve where it's working so that people can better connect the dots.
I mean, I
And
don't
how
want
did
to
this
take.
idea of, so how did this idea of a foundation come about in the first place? Because if you take Ranthambore, the budget should be coming from the Rajasthan Forest Department. What is this notion of a foundation?
So I think BROMO broadly, my understanding, subject correction, is that in the run-up to the loss of the tiger from Sariska, which led to the creation of the Tiger Task Force, which looked at a whole range of associated issues, one of the things that was happening is that these parks were, some of these parks were formidable in their capacity to generate revenue through tourism and other non-consumptive, non-extractive uses of wildlife and so on. And they were having to surrender those gate fees and all of those things to the exchequer and only make do with the allocations that were made within the larger government process. So a few imaginative ways were devised in during a project in the Periyar Tiger Reserve, which I think was held out as a model for how parks by themselves could function somewhat independently by generating resources that can be within their administrative jurisdiction and utilizing that by themselves, and it and doing so with a greater degree of independence. And that was felt so rather than I would have imagined that one of the ways in which it could be done was to actually remove the requirement that this actually has to move through the treasury and so on, but the response was to create these additional layers, which was like a government operated NGO with which also has overlap in jurisdiction and has is empowered in law to participate in the management of these areas. And I think it's this place where it's while it's freedom is one edge of it, it's a double-edged sword. The other is that it also makes the entire process that had to happen under close government supervision, like, I mean, being answerable to the Public Accounts Committee would have been something that every park and would have previously had to do. But for money that's not either generated within the government system and so on, it's these are audited separately, these are maintained as separate from the park's books. And I think it makes it possible for a range of perversions to become possible. I'm not saying it's invariably the case. So I'm saying that this there is a thin fault line that has been created, and this can be the place where one can come in and say, I mean, we've in this case, like just to take a more the example that has been raised here, we've had the public servants saying the private sector is much better. And we don't have funds. It's much harder for us to do this. Tomorrow, it can actually be that one of our tiger reserves can just have an MOU. The foundation can have an MOU with another foundation, which has a lot of money, and that can be a corporate foundation. Or it can, in fact, be a corporation itself. And then Avi, and it can bring in so much money, so much more money than the government is currently putting into this. It might make many things better, but is there something we're losing in this transition? That's, I think, the question we must ponder. I'm not saying it's invariably bad or it's, but I think these are changes, imminent changes that have, I mean, I think they forecast far bigger changes to the foundations of how we have done wildlife conservation in this country.
Absolutely. And Madhu, I think just one question to you before I jump across to Shivani as well. I wanted to ask you as well. I mean, you've seen this close up, this shift, both globally and within India, the one you're talking about, where the state tends, has tended to relinquish its role as a protector of public and common goods, including wildlife areas, and relinquish that to the private and the corporate sector. Where is the conservation community on all of this? Where are the conservation organizations? I'm sure that you've heard multiple reactions, some of them public, some of them private. I'm sure that there are things that people have to be careful about. But I did want to ask you this. Where does you've seen this change, this shift happen over the course of your career. What have you seen in terms of how the wider field has been reacting or understanding this, and also any misgivings in terms of where things are going next?
I mean, there's a very wide range of responses and reactions, and whatever I say will necessarily be a simplification of that. But very broadly, I think in the kind of issues that we're talking about, a rescue center and so on, there is one kind of a dichotomy that I think on which the community falls on two sides. One, which is issues of the wild versus captivity. There are many people who work passionately to protect natural areas, I mean, protected areas, wildlife, forests in the natural context. And they're really, I mean, their eyes glaze over when you're talking about zoos, rescue facilities, and animals that are not in a wild context. So, and I think this kind of what we are seeing here lends itself to very easily saying, yeah, I mean, they're building a big rescue facility. It's fine. It's not what's the, I mean, it's not the first private rescue center that's been built. So what's the big deal? It might be a bigger one than anything else that's been built before that. Beyond that, what is there? So I think there is that part where there is a community that isn't really looking at this because it has any great relevance to conservation in the wild. There are people who are actually seeing the connections a lot more deeper, who are very worried about this. And I think the other is the whole range of organizations have a much more academic orientation towards conservation, the science, and so on. And there, it's largely, I think, their orientation towards what's happening in the wild, with species extinctions, and population declines. All of that, when you metricize the whole thing and make it into data that we really need and evidence that has to be used for policy and so on. The focus is about a whole range of ecological processes unfolding in ecological arenas. But I think so that's the other divide between the academic and non-academic the parts of the community. There, I think it's necessary to recognize, and not everyone is oriented that way, that conservation is not ecological processes unfolding in an ecological arena. It's about ecological and social processes unfolding in a political arena. And I think many academic researchers and so on do not have the bandwidth, the appetite, or even the disciplinary training to be able to take in complexities of social complexities and political realities, read between lines and see what's going on. And I think that also makes engagement with some of these things necessarily harder. And I think finally, I'd like to say this is not a great time at all to be part of the civil society today, regardless of the sector in which you function. And the risk is existential for most organizations. And I think they're extremely afraid for themselves, and they have a good sense of where power lies and what is going to let them see another financial year and run another bunch of programs versus what is going to put them at death's door. And I think many of them are extremely guarded. And I think this is really where I see a lot of, but of course, there are individuals, and I mean, there are exceptions to all of this. And that too, I think, must be said.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Madhu. Yeah, I think so many more questions that we could follow on with from that, but I think, yeah, we'll jump across to Shibani as well, because I know that, of course, there are so many questions to ask of you as well, Shibani. Maybe to start off, I mean, I think building on what both Shekhar and Madhu were saying, of course, from your perspective as a lawyer, there have been changes playing out when it comes to the Wildlife Protection Act, but also just the broader regulatory and legal framework when it comes to conservation and wildlife. I wanted to, I mean, of course, the story touches upon a few of these things in a little bit of detail, but not all that much. I did want to ask if you could maybe try and put all of that together from the big picture point of view that you hold, in terms of what are the most salient views or changes that you've seen to the laws and regulations on all of this, not just in terms of the law, but also in terms of the jurisprudence.
Right. Well, that's a tough one. And I'm not sure I can do justice while responding to it. Well, I mean, there are a lot of not just, I mean, we're of course talking about wildlife, and I wish we could continue, just listening to Dr. Madhusudan, because it's just such a great learning experience. I mean, it's not just wildlife, but just environmental regulation more generally has in the last some years, a couple of decades, has really been going through quite an upheaval. And there we do see certain shifts in paradigm in terms of what is the government of the day trying to achieve? Is the objective clear? Is what it does align with the objective that it's trying to achieve? And how does the objective really play out with its constitutional role? And as a lawyer, I'm also forced to say that how does it play out with what the jurisprudence of the court, the Supreme Court, and then the High Court says in terms of the environmental jurisprudence that has evolved quite significantly over the last 2 or 3 decades around environmental issues. Wildlife, in fact, the Wildlife Protection Act was one of our first environmental legislations post independence passed by our parliament. And India, in fact, is one of the leaders in terms of legislative action on environmental issues, not so much in terms of the implementation part of it, but whether it's wildlife, whether it's pollution, forest conservation, we have been one of the leaders in terms of national legislation, but in terms of implementation, of course, it's been very poor. And that actually brings me to when we're talking about the laws, Roman, I think it's important also to talk about, as you pointed out, the implementation regime of that. And it was interesting, both Shekhar and Dr. Madhusudan before me talked about regulatory agencies. I mean, there was a reference to the National Board before this. But if you look at regulatory agencies across environment regulation, whether it's, the pollution control boards, the expert appraisal committees, the departments involved in these kind of things, all of them play such a critical role in the design, the implementation, the monitoring, and the enforcement of the law, that it's very odd that when we are talking about lawmaking, when we are discussing what are the changes in the law, as you asked me, often we don't consider the capacity and capabilities of the nuts and bolts of the system. Now, if you are going to, which is what happened recently, the Wildlife Protection Act was amended. Part of the amendment was kind of rationalizing the schedules to the wildlife law. And, you know, there are many people who are participating in this call who probably know a lot more about what that means on ground in terms of research and in terms of protection and conservation. And so I don't want to go into that. But it also in terms of the enforcement part of it, there is a move not only in the wildlife sector, but also if you look at the pollution control laws, about moving, kind of rationalizing the punitive system or the manner in which offenses are prosecuted, what are the punishments. There is this whole kind of, we need to move away from the criminal prosecution way, move towards civil offenses. We need to rationalize all that. Yes, but why, right? Are you rationalizing all this? Are you amending these laws because you think that would make them stricter? Would that make our environmental regulation would better? Would that protect our wildlife more? And when we are talking about wildlife, as Dr. Madhusudan before me said, wildlife is not just the animals, but the landscape, the habitats. Is that what the amendments are trying to achieve? Or are they trying to achieve some alternative policy objectives, which may be absolutely fair objectives, development imperatives, absolutely fair, but don't necessarily align with environmental objectives. In fact, may completely conflict with the environmental concerns. And in that situation, it is a question that who holds the interests of environment, whether non-human or human, and who speaks for them. So if we have, for instance, you know, a species which are at brink of extinction, endangered species, who speaks for them when their habitat is pitted against infrastructural potential or infrastructural expansion, right? So we cannot possibly be relying on one individual, one foundation, one NGO, one panchayat to bring that up. We then have to turn to the state, because as you started that whole conversation today, what is the position of state in environmental protection, in wildlife protection? It's the law of our land that all of this is held by the state in trust. They are the trustees. And I mean, if we were to accept the Supreme Court's word on it, which we have to, and I certainly have to as a lawyer, the public trust doctrine, which is the law of our land, requires the state, whether it's the central government or the state government or any other subnational actor, to act as a trustee, because they're holding it for us, for the public, to ensure that they continue in perpetuity, to ensure that all of us can enjoy these natural resources, which are for the public benefit, and also to make sure that if they have to be allocated, which many of our natural resources have to be allocated, they have to be allocated in a fair, transparent, accountable manner. So there's so many of these issues which are across procedure, across regulatory agencies, some of which were touched upon earlier. So the question then is, are our laws being amended to achieve those objectives? And I would say the answer is a kind of no. And that's really unfortunate, because, you know, if you look at some of our regulatory agencies, they are, and I wouldn't say funding is necessarily a problem, though that's often kind of the you know, red flag that we don't have money, we're a developing country. That isn't. A lot of the studies show that, you know, boards and regulatory agencies are not lacking in money. What they're lacking in, for instance, is good leadership. We talked about conflict of interest. Dr. Madhusudan talked about a board of wildlife conflict of interest. Again, coming back to a pollution control board example, there are several studies which show that there are people who are from departments that are potentially polluting who are on the decision-making board. So those kind of issues are issues which I think affect the manner in which our laws are implemented, including the Wildlife Protection Act. And just the last point I want to make before, Roman, I'll go back to you, is that I think what we really need to do is two things. One, we really need to set our conversation in the context of climate change. I mean, I think that's just something that we can, that's, should I be saying elephant in the room? It kind of seems the wrong wrong phrase to use. but really kind of everything kind of changes, you know, when we're talking about the context of climate change. But secondly, the way our laws are set up, environmental regulation needs convergence. So you cannot have a system which says, okay, you need to get the wildlife clearance from the chief wildlife warden, you need to get it from the department, and then say, oh, you need to go and get the environmental clearance from a whole different department, you need to go and get the forest clearance from a whole different. So if we continue to talk of all our laws in different ways and not consider convergence, there is no way we are going to be talking about habitat protection, no way we're going to be talking about habitat restoration. Some people ask the question about, you know, why are we only looking at key species? You're right. Why are we only looking at key species? So yeah, I'm going to stop there.
Actually, Shekhar, before I hand over to you, I mean, I just want to also acknowledge, I mean, one of the questions that we got in the email was also about the climate change angle. I mean, also asking about whether there's, you know, whether we can estimate the carbon footprint of this particular project. I don't think there's any way for us to do that. But I think that, yeah, Shivani, I think you've done an admirable job there of setting it in that bigger picture. It's not about carbon footprint so much alone. It's about much more in terms of the bigger picture on all of this. Yeah, Shekhar, you wanted to jump in?
Okay, Shibani, one question. I mean, we've known each other for a really long time from writing on air quality and whatnot, and therefore Central Pollution Control Board. Weak enforcement, weakening regulation has been a mainstay of our environmental management for a while. What we are seeing here is the crossing of a Rubicon, where we are saying that not only will we continue to weaken these environmental protections, we are now going to offload a part of biodiversity management or wildlife management onto the private sector, right? How did this particular point get crossed? And then the whole pre-legislative process comes in here, because to effect such a shift, right, what should be the process followed?
Right. So Shekhar, I don't think there was a single point in time when this shift has happened, right? It's happened gradually, maybe at some points it was faster than others, but there has always been this move towards wanting to release control from the government, at least in environmental regulation, and I can only speak from there. Even in other parts of, you know, you see third-party certification becoming a thing now, that you want to talk about whether industries are compliant with their what the requirements are. There is a move towards bringing third parties in. There's a move towards bringing third party auditors in, and you know that and third parties, therefore meaning private players. I mean that move is there, and I don't think I can identify one particular point of time when that happened. However, I can point to a few factors why that could be happening. One is, as you mentioned, the weakening enforcement regime. There just doesn't seem to be a will to strengthen what we already have. We always have this tendency that, oh, this authority didn't work, let's replace it with a new authority. Or this board didn't work, let's see if we can come up with a new commission. Now, the reason why the earlier agency did not work is something that our government, whether at the center or the state level, they don't seem to be good at figuring out a problem, the problem. They seem to be better off suggesting solutions. And when you haven't really figured out what the problem is, your solutions seem to mismatch. And therefore, when you're talking about, okay, so there's weak enforcement. Now, why is there weak enforcement? Perhaps the weak enforcement is because you just don't have enough boots on ground. The latest studies of the government, and I'm not even looking at non-governmental private enterprise reports, they say we are running at high vacancies of sanctioned posts in environmental departments and in pollution control boards. And assuming sanctioned posts are enough, and I don't know the studies on wildlife boards and wildlife departments, and I suspect it will be similar. There's no reason why wildlife would be better off than other environmental departments. So therefore, this... And then to say, oh, we don't have the money. Again, it's the wrong diagnosis of the problem. You may have the money. You just don't spend it in the right way. So many departments, so many states, the money goes back to the treasury because they haven't spent it that year. Next year, their budget gets cut down because you didn't spend it the first year. We have so many. We have, I mean, many of you, and I can see participants in this group have written so much on the CAMPA fund. You've written on the environmental compensation charge. There isn't lack of money. If we want to move into mission mode on anything, we can, right? So it's again, to diagnose that, oh, we need money is not the problem. So, you know, there's this whole thing, and someone asked this question on green credits and things like that, which are now getting rolled in. You know, there's a question, is that what was lacking in our forest protection that we needed to bring in these things? But just to end there, Shekhar, I do not have a problem with experimenting with new models of regulation. Clearly, there is something wrong with our existing model of regulation. There is no doubt. what we originally called the command and control, you know, or the carrot and stick approach. Here are the rules, you follow them. If you don't, you go to jail. That's not worked for us. I agree. Let's go in for hybrid models. That's fine. But you can't go in for these hybrid models without evidence. And that's where when you talk about, you talked about pre-legislative processes. What was the evidence that went into deciding which species should go into which schedule, for instance? What is the evidence that says that if you want to move away from criminal prosecution to civil offenses and penalties, that this has worked anywhere, right? Even in India, okay, go ahead, do it in one district and tell us that the district magistrate or the revenue administration is so well positioned as opposed to a pollution control board to assess the damage to environment, to a wildlife habitat, to a pond, to a lake, or whatever it is. Do the pilot, use the evidence. I think there's so many scientists and experts, and I don't want to focus expertise on science. I think that, of course, and I'm sure there are people in this room who'd agree, in this virtual room who'd agree that expertise comes across board diversity. Bring that evidence. That's the problem. Our policy is not based on evidence. I think that's that, and that's why solutions don't match the problem.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to introduce one tiny factoid here, deeply relevant.
Go for it.
The son of Parimal Nathwani, one of the chief senior executives of Reliance, is Dhanraj Nathwani, right? He's a member of the State Wildlife Board in Gujarat, right? So when we start then talking about why Reliance is chosen for these leopards and so on, you know, conflict of interest runs right over all of this. Okay, Roman, back to you.
Thank you, Shekhar. I think I'm also seeing that we've crossed the hour mark, and I think it's not just questions that are coming from the audience. I think we've got a full debate going in the chat section, which is great. Also great to see that there's a lot of people here who really know a lot of the law and a lot of the context, legal context and otherwise. So maybe if I can already start going through some of these questions, and I'm sure that will give all of you more to add to what you were saying as well. Several questions. I mean, this is both from the emailed questions or the registration questions earlier and also here in the chat. Ishita and others have raised the question, I think, or at least in comments, of the non-Indian species that are coming in, both to Vantara and also elsewhere. Of course, this is something elsewhere, meaning, you know, just into the country more broadly. Of course, in the context of Vantara with the Spix macaws and other species, this is something that we've covered in the story, and I don't want to go over that again. Please, anybody who's curious and not read the story, please read the second part of it, it's all there. But one question that did come in relation to those is, what part does or did the Indian government play in those international transfers coming in from organizations like, I think, the ACTP, right, from Germany, which is the organization that sent the Spix macaws. So leaving that open, for all of you, I think all of you would probably have knowledge and expertise on that. When it comes to regulating transfers of that sort, of course, there is CITES, there's an international framework, but in what ways does the Indian government also fit into that picture?
I think I better take this one.
Sure.
So if you look at Aquaba, right, the Captain Lion Farm, which sort of sent 531 charismatic megafauna to Jamnagar. The paper trail that we know about is one where Reliance wrote to the Environment Ministry or wrote to the Gujarat Forest Department, Environment Department, which sent that letter on to the Union Environment Ministry, which approved the transfer. Okay. We have information about this transaction over and above this. Right? This and therefore, it's a very hard question to answer. I mean, even in the case of the Spix macaws, we haven't really seen the Indian delegation making any kind of a contribution to the debate in CITES, right? So it's one of those black box transfers from me as of now, I have no idea. And whether it should be such a black box activity is a question we need to ask, because you're bringing in animals from all over the world at a time when habitats are being destroyed, creating the risk of zoonosis and zoonotic diseases, right? Presumably, there should be greater discussion of all this.
Yeah. Shivani, Madhu, anything to add to that?
Nope.
Okay. Moving on to other questions. Neha Lalchandani had asked about rehabilitation and whether that's part of the bigger picture here. And I think I want to kind of open that question up a little bit. From what we know and what we see of the public communication from Vantara, they have said that rehabilitation is part of the plans, correct? At least to some extent, Shekhar?
Only for the conservation breeding program.
Understood.
Right. And there are questions, because if you want to do conservation breeding and release into the wild, then these animals are better, these birds, fix my cause, are better off being sent to Brazil, mm-hmm. right? So there are two questions, right? I mean, if you look at ACTP is saying that we want to reduce biosecurity risk by creating a separate population and not keeping all our individuals only in one location in Germany. If that is your objective, then wouldn't Brazil, which is the national home of this species, a better fit? A. B. Why is a rescue center located in the middle of the world's biggest petrochem refinery a better choice, even if it is exceptionally well capitalized?
Mm-hmm.
Flip it around. Look at it from the Greens' point of view. If conservation breeding is a priority for them, what is the track record of ACTP in reintroduction of wild species into the wild? Right. So those are the questions that I have. I think Madhu can answer this one better on what it takes to reintroduce a species into the wild.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think in terms of from what we know of the facility and the location of Vantara, how does that look to somebody with your expertise as a conservationist in terms of what the best practices and the most successful practices in terms of reintroduction, rehabilitation might be for a conservation breeding program, at least?
No, often I'm reminded of a paper over two decades ago that was written by Alan Rabinowitz, which was titled Helping a Species Go Extinct. And it was a very powerful critique of captive breeding as a way of trying to save species from extinction, taking the example of the Sumatran rhino. And I think one of the headline points of what he was trying to do is that enormous amounts of technical expertise, money and brain power, money power, all kind of political negotiations, all kinds of things were overcome in order to conceptualize a captive breeding program for the Sumatran rhino, which in very large part did not allow a male and a female to be together in the same place. They were taking animals into captivity. No breeding happened, or very little of it happened, for the simple reason that these were ending up being collections. These were animals being brought from the wild, but the actual breeding, in order to release, forget the release part, the breeding didn't happen. And that was, I think, a reminder of how we can take a conservation problem, I mean, a problem like extinction, and make it incredibly technical and seem like the answer lies in a huge amount of technical expertise, capital intensive investments, and doing big, big things in order to save a species. Often, you really, and let me come to the reintroduction part. Fine, you are able to do it. You are able to breed species in captivity. What was the original reason that drove a species to its precarious state? And what has been done to ensure that that driver has been removed? The people who are sitting and breeding these animals and looking at the captive facilities are not the ones managing habitats. And the ones managing habitats are not the ones. So when you increase this disconnect and make it more technical, in each silo, every activity becomes more reasonable, rational, and so on. But when you try to put it all together, Where are you going to put a species that has been bred in captivity, if at all that's happened? And it's not that this has not been done. It's been done in places. It's an incredibly difficult job, and it requires a deep commitment, not phenomenal technical capabilities. I think technical capabilities are for sure helpful, but it needs a very deep engagement with the socio-political realities of conservation and understanding how to reverse the causes, the drivers of what in the first place drove these species to the brink. Without having gotten rid of them, we can, and I think we're demonstrating it in to some extent, that we can have, exaggerated and glorified zoos that can keep species with the appearance of them being in the wild and so on. And we can invest phenomenal, and we can mobilize phenomenal amounts of money to do this. But what role does it actually serve in terms of, finding a place for a species in its natural habitat? Often, I think all we need to do is address the drivers to begin with. If I don't think we need to have gotten to a point where things are really bleak, and then invest in technical interventions, and then try to go back and reintroduce. I think early, if we move early, fast and early, I think there are many, many species that can actually be prevented from getting to the brink. That is not the place where we're doing this. I think with the exception of the pygmy hog, I may be wrong here, but I think there are very, very few species that have, and that is a project that has taken incredible amounts of understanding, imagination, and on ground, deep on ground engagement for decades for something like this to have happened. And
Absolutely.
I don't know if that can actually be matched and found in every place. It's not, I don't think that's the answer. It's certainly not the first answer. It may be way down the line. I'm not ruling it out. I'm not running it down. But it's not the first answer to what conservation problems ail endangered species or species on the brink of extinction.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madhu. I'm gonna keep going through the questions, and I think again just lumping a few of these together. There's a question from Suraj in the chat about do zoos have animal audits, but I'm going to open that question up a little bit also. There's also several questions in the questions from the registration about just how many species are there? How do we know how many species and animals there are at Vantara? So I'm going to split these questions into two. One very quickly to Shekhar for the benefit of everyone here who's curious. What are the publicly available sources that are out there on this particular project, Vantara? Just if you can summarize those. And beyond that, also, I mean, this is Shekhar, both to you and certainly to Shivani and Madhu, possibly to you as well. As a private entity that now has custody of these animals, when it comes to auditing or any kind of legally mandated government oversight, official oversight, where do the lines now lie now that these animals are actually in the custody of a private entity? What can the government check on? What can they not check on? Where do the lines lie on this?
I see that the Spanish Inquisition is well and truly underway. In terms of public data on this, right, a primary source of data for us were the annual reports that all zoos have to submit to the Central Zoo Authority. So if you go to czra.nic.in and you look at public institutions or public data and search for the zoo you want to look at, you will get an inventory, their annual report. It's not a financial annual report, it's an inventory of the species they have. How many animals do they have? What was the mortality? What was the number of arrivals? The number of departures? I mean, exchanges from one zoo to the other. These reports are supposed to be audited. I don't know if there are surprise inspections from time to time. What complicates things in the case of Vantara is that it's inside a private facility, the Reliance Refinery. So, what is the capacity of the Gujarat Forest Department to go into the refinery and do a surprise inspection? Okay, given again the political economy of Gujarat and the oversized influence of Reliance in this country. So, that's my part of the answer.
Shivani, Madhu.
Well, I was just going to say that zoos have to be audited by the Central Zoo Authority on a regular basis. So that's one regulatory scrutiny process they are supposed to undergo. How well that happens across the country, not just in this particular one, is, you know, up for discussion.
I don't have a direct answer. I just want to go back to Raj's article about the elephants. And then with an animal of the size of an elephant, if we are not able to establish and track provenance, it's just a reminder that you can do your audits, you can have the procedures laid out. It's extremely difficult to actually implement them. Mm. And I think if it's the case with elephants, imagine what's happening to smaller animals that can be moved around much, much more easily than in the back of trucks. So I think it's not a direct answer. Second, I think the larger, everywhere in the regulatory process, I think there are conditional grants. There are, as Shivani said in a earlier, it's the government's job to actually harmonize multiple claims over land, resources, priorities, and so on. And I think a government of the time has the mandate to take its preferred route. And I think citizens have a right to ask of the government, and the government a responsibility to respond to citizens of how it has made the choices that it has made. So in the regulatory process, we are often having to make decisions in an environmental context. We are often having to make decisions that are not in the interest of conservation. And I think, so there are conditional clearances granted. If your clearance for an activity is granted, if a certain activity is held back, if something that is undermining environment is rolled back, or something else is done that is either corrective or mitigatory and so on. But the point I'm trying to make is that every permission, whether it's given by the ESC, the FAC, the National Board for Wildlife, the Environment Appraisal Committee, the Forest Advisory Committee, or the National Board for Wildlife, they have long lists of things that can and can't be done. I don't know of instances where an audit has been done of all projects permitted with particular conditions. I don't know why every project is not audited. I don't know why audit reports are not made public, whether there is any follow-up for compliance. The conditions are put, and that is it. That's largely it. It's voluntary reporting, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Thank you. I'm going to keep zipping through some of these questions. We have a question from Arun about whether the land was illegally bought or encroached upon. That is answered in the piece. Please go ahead and check it there. There's a question from Mukund about the role of the Supreme Court in all of this. Again, something that we've covered clearly in the piece. Please go and take another look there. There's also questions about what might have made Reliance and Anand Ambani, this is a question from Lakshmi about what might have motivated them to start all of this. Again, something that we've looked at in the piece. So yeah, for those of you who haven't read the piece in its entirety, just another reminder to please go and read it more closely. There's also a bunch of questions that I think are questions of legitimate concern. Asking about, you know, what happens, you know, Arjun Singh, for instance, you have the question about, does the author suspect Reliance will start a business selling ivory, animal products, etc.? There's another question, similar question about, you know, whether private, this is from Dhananjay, whether private entities coming into wildlife conservation can provoke unregulated and unsupervised illicit breeding of protected species. Now, again, I mean, there we have no way of knowing what Reliance's ultimate intent is. I mean, we can only raise the questions that are in the piece, so you should please go there. Shekhar, you wanted to jump in on this?
Yeah. So there is a point here about transparency. You know, in the absence of information, everybody is going to start locking into some pet theory, some pet hypothesis of theirs, and then arrange the facts in such a way that it feels like this could be the only logical terminus for whatever is going on. Right? I've heard about them wanting to donate elephants to temples. I've heard about this whole thing of ivory. I've heard about this whole thing of a range of other uses, man, breeding and so on and so forth. And there are, I think, at this time, I don't think I would take any of these conjectures seriously because it's just conjecture. Right? One, two, very often, how a project evolves is actually the result of happenstance. At this time, reliance is phenomenally powerful. Right? I don't know how things change at a time of a global energy transition, and I write on energy, and therefore I really know what I'm talking about here. Right? This is a petrochemical refinery. Right? As the energy transition gathers steam, what if, and given the kind of easy in Fortune 500 companies and so on, what if Reliance is not as powerful as it is today, another 20 years later? How does that change the future for these animals? Right? You may say right now that we will never do breeding, we will never sort of, use this for commercial exploitation or anything. Who knows what happens 20 years later? The animals will live that long, several of them.
Yeah, and might not be under
And
Reliance's custody at that point at all. Who
we
knows?
don't know. And
Yeah.
that is the reason why this has to be under the trusteeship of the state. The state will live longer than any corporation. A and B, even if you want to privatize it, please tell us the conditions which are being sort of invoked to make sure that these concerns are addressed. As of now, I haven't seen a single condition around the future of these animals. The whole thing, they've just been given a permission to sort of have a rescue center and a zoo, right? What is the long-term plan?
Absolutely. We are coming up on an hour and a half, which is where we want to end this. I do have one last question to all of the panelists. Before we get to it, I want to say a big thank you once more to all of you and also to everybody in the audience. Once again, please support Himal, support independent media, support investigative journalism, which there is definitely not enough of across our whole region in India and elsewhere. So please become patrons and help us put the next big story like this together, so that we can keep doing these kinds of conversations and keep bringing out information and raising the questions that must be raised in a democracy. With that, I want to turn to a question that I thought maybe would be best saved for last. This is from Tarini, who brings up the work of Mahesh Rangarajan on Project Tiger and the political and specifically on the also political impulses that Project Tiger embodied and also the political paradigm within which it was formed. If we were to treat this as not quite a Project Tiger, but something still very significant, a very telling and landmark project within the larger history of Indian conservation. What would this one tell us about the present political moment, especially when it comes to imaginations and treatment of nature and government approach to it, and also just the political economy of all of this? I know that's a sweeping question. Madhu, you've touched upon a lot of that already, of course, but I thought that maybe that could be the one that we all end on. So with thanks to everybody for being here. Thank you to the Himal team one more time for all the hard work. Thank you to the panelists. And yeah, I'll leave that question open for all of you to take on.
Shall we get Shibani to go first?
Sure.
Well, I was hoping Dr. Madhusudan will go first, but I feel it's much more in his wheelhouse than mine. So I was hoping he would take the lead on this. But in any case, I mean, I'm not sure it's a great analogy, at least given my understanding of Professor Mahesh Rangarajan's work and how much I understand as a coming from my background. But I would say that today, I mean, Shekhar's article, what it writes about today's discussion, it is an I mean, it is an instance of what's happening around us in terms of there is so much more the state needs to invest in, not just in terms of money, to do its job with regard to environmental protection. I think Dr. Madhusudan said this so many times, and it can be said so many more times, that the causes that require rescue and rehabilitation need to be addressed. Yes. But we also need more rescue and rehabilitation centers because we already are in a position where we have several species which require rescue and rehabilitation. And there I would, and urge, I really think the state needs to rethink its position on this and rethink its policy on this and push for this because these are expensive endeavors. I mean, I keep saying finance may not be a consideration, but it is an expensive endeavor. And as Shekhar mentioned in his final comments, that the state lasts rather lasts longer than a corporation. So I mean, it is the state's responsibility to see that there is a backup of some sort for all of these species and where they are. So in that sense, I think for the state to kind of rethink its policy. And I just wanted to put in a last bit there that, I at least use the word state as if it's one entity, but it's not. And it's so many different entities which are often working together, often not working together. And I think that's something perhaps to keep in mind when we are talking about and discussing issues of privatization, role of state, that there is no single state in some ways. So I'll end there and hand over to the other
Thank you,
panelists.
Shivani.
I don't think I'm such a good reader of political tea leaves, and I don't know what moment in what political moment we'd be looking at, we are looking at right now. But I think there are some differences that do stand out. At the point at which Project Tiger was conceptualized, these were the Cold War years. It was happening just a couple of decades after zamindari abolition, nationalization of banks, the state went and had a whole range of other investments into welfare and so on, which really brought the state in a very big way. And to that larger heft and capability, Project Tiger gave a very sharp edge and definition in terms of focusing it on conservation. And a lot of it also was done as a demonstration of the capability that we have within the country to address the challenges that we are facing, namely the precipitous decline of the tiger. What happened subsequently, I mean, it's at best a very mixed bag, but nevertheless, that was really the moment when I think the state was stepping up to a task that none other than the state could have responded to in a very big way. And I think the present moment, I don't know if it's a moment or a smear of time that's been happening over the last couple of decades, which is these are times when the state is retreating. The state has retreated from so many places. And the retreat is not, I mean, I keep coming back to this. It's not legally an abdication. It's not technically an abandoning. None of those things are a wholesale change. But I think in all the omissions, in the looking away, in the kind of things that are being done, the state, wherever it can and should be stepping up and taking note of if there are, so how did we come to a situation where a project of this sort, like Vantara, is held out as an exemplar of a lot of good things that the private sector could do, things that the government cannot do, and a case is being made for a closer working together or whatever it might be. The problem with that is that there isn't a clear enough vision that is underlying this change in direction. There is a very big shift in direction. And there isn't a strong enough articulation of why we are having to do that, and a clear enough articulation of why we are having to do that It's like it's largely in autopilot, and I think that's and as in the gradients that are being created in the directions where wildlife conservation is being taken by the currents of today is where wildlife conservation is going, and I think those are largely in the in what David Harvey's called, accumulation by dispossession in a lot of different ways, and I say this beyond humans and so on, and I think this is there isn't a very clear articulation, and at this moment I see more of an abdication, a retreat, than I see of an emphatic statement that we as a country are capable of protecting our animals. We are happy to do the talk and leave the walk aside.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madhu. That's very admirably summed up, I think. Shekhar, I think
Okay.
perhaps suitably back to the star of the hour. I will call you that again.
You really should
Have
do
the last
this.
word.
So to go to Project Tiger, right? Project Tiger is a state which believes it can handle a complex problem, right? What I was seeing this time around is a very, very underconfident state. Multiple people will say, we are not able to do this. It's much better that the private sector come in. It's much better that the private sector come in is again a part of a much larger shift where progressively this country has come to decide. I mean, we saw this with Aadhaar as well, right? That the private sector exemplifies delivery, the state cannot deliver, right? And what I see and what I saw repeatedly in the reportage is this lack of confidence within the state that it could solve the problem. One reason for this lack of confidence is also about the absolute weakening of the state, not only through a range of sort of blandishments, whatever you have, that people sort of officials really feel that the state is indeed incapable of handling these issues now. Right? So there is a mindset part of it where you think that the private sector can do it. There is the political economy part of it, which doesn't let you do your job even if you want to. And then you end up at this very facile point where you say that anybody, and there is a general dumbing down of society as well when people start saying things like anybody with passion should be allowed to come in and work on wildlife. What is passion, man? It's rhetoric. In the same way that now we've reached a point where it has to be explained patiently to people that endangered species should not be in an industrial zone. I find that extraordinary. I don't think we would have needed to make that argument 30 years ago.
Good point to end on. I think bringing it all back to where it all started for this discussion, at least in Jamnagar. Thank you once again to all of you. Have a good morning if you're on the other side of the world. If you're on this side of the world, then have a good night. Yeah, Shekhar,
One
thank
last thing,
you.
a
Please.
big thank you to Himal for telling this story. The story was really well edited by Roman. It's extremely readable despite its length. And thank you for giving it a really quick processing and for publishing it.
And
Thank you.
thank you to you for doing all the legwork and paper chasing and everything else that it took. Yeah, maybe one thing to end on. I think I speak for both Shekhar and for me. When again, we can't say this enough. Madhu, you were talking about it being a tough time for everyone in civil society, etc. It's definitely a hell of a time to be a journalist on many, many fronts, and we could use all the help we can get. Please become a patron. Please help Himal. And not just Himal, please support independent media wherever you're seeing good work being done. Thank you to all of you for joining us. Thank you one last time, hugely, to the panel, Madhu,
Thank you.
and yeah, Shivani, both of you, it's such a pleasure.
Thanks
Pops,
a lot.
thank you all.
Bye.